Night fell across the terrace. In the distance, the passenger ferry cut across the dark sea in a steady sweep of light.
"Us tomorrow," said the kid,
still high from diving amongst sea urchins. Ulysses brought a candle to his face and lit a cigarette. On the table, a scattering of nutshells and empty salad plates. Massimo poured out the wine, and Claude thought about saying a few words, but the moment passed. A moon and bats and the pulse of a docile sea and friendship and the start of a new venture. Nothing more to say. Except...
"You need a name," said Claude,
chewing on a piece of watermelon.
"What about the Bertolini?" said the kid. "If it ain't broke."
They all laughed, and the kid felt a million bucks and a little bit tired. So, that was how the Pensione Bertolini, Mark II, came to pass. Cress would eventually tell that story to every guest who wanted to listen. Bit of history for them to take away. Bit of him, really. He went to bed fizzing that night. So bright, you could have seen him from space. They came back to the city refreshed. The island had done its best, had grounded them and introduced them to a way of life they would aspire to and return to. Cress fixed the overhead fan in Michele's, and when that strong current of air moved steadily through the bar, everybody cheered. Michele lifted Cress off the ground, and to those watching, it was like the smothering of a small goat by a bear. Ulysses went to Palazzo Castellani, the Institute of the History of Science, and spent time with Coronelli's globes. They were more beautiful than he'd imagined, and he thought about the worlds his father had created, brightly coloured spheres with pink for the empire. He'd paint the world differently, naturally. Green for forests, white for ice, brown for land, and blue for sea. He'd readjust the borders and give countries back their names. And then bang on the kid's birthday, three letters arrived from Peg of all people. In the letter dated June, Peg had written her new telephone number at the bottom of the page, and Ulysses and the kid ran to Massimo's office.
"Un momento,"
said the young woman, who connected the call.
"I'm 8,
said the kid, pushing back her fringe.
"Who'd have believed it?"
And she told Peg that she'd got a guitar from Ulysses and Cress, a diving mask from Massimo, and Signora Giulia had made a cannoli.
"She's from Sicily," she said. "All in all, a good haul."
Kid covered the receiver and turned to Ulysses.
"Peg said she sent me money."
Kid looked delighted. Ulysses heard Peg sing Happy Birthday and he left the room to give the kid privacy. But really, it was because it broke his fucking heart. He waited in the hallway till the kid called his name.
"Peg wants to speak to you," she said,
giving him the receiver. Kid went outside with a young woman to learn how to make an espresso. "I'm sorry," he said.
"About what?" said Peg.
"Remember us."
"If that's the worst of your attempts, I got off lightly."
"Work okay," he said.
"Teb wants me to give it up."
"You won't, will you?"
"Wants me to marry him."
"Don't," he said.
"What, work or marriage?"
"Just don't, Peg." And Ulysses lit a cigarette.
"Alice sounds happy."
"She is. Come see for yourself. She told you about the pensione?"
"What the fuck's a pensione?"
he laughed. "A small hotel."
"You got that many rooms?"
"Daft right."
"Here, Peg, you got a pen?"
"Take this number down. There's a cafe. You can always leave a message."
"You got it?"
"Got it."
"Here. What happened with Ginny?" "Didn't you read the letter, Temps?"
"Came straight here, didn't read anything."
"I told Mrs. Corr about her and Devi."
"You did?"
"Had to, but I trust her. She reminds me of your mum. She's so kind and calm and treats Ginny like family. It's really sweet the way she is with them. The boy is too. I'll tell Cole when he's ready to listen."
"We love you, Peg."
"What's that?"
"I said."
"You still there, Temps?"
"Temps?" When September arrived, it brought cooler nights and the long goodbye of the swallows. Ulysses disappeared too, just for the day. This was something he would do year after year, and eventually Cress and the kid stopped asking where he went. Kid and Cress made a coloured lantern and joined the procession for the Festa della Rificolona, the celebration of the birth of the Virgin Mary.
Kid said, "You can't be a virgin and give birth, can you, Cress?"
And Cress said, "No, you can't."
"Just checking I wasn't missing anything," said the kid.
In the Tuscan vineyards, the grape harvest began, and in the bakeries appeared the traditional sweet flatbread, schiacciata all'uva. Restaurants previously closed for August reopened with new menus, heavy on the porcini. And finally, as much as the kid tried to evade all mention of it, September brought school. The night before, she was nervous and didn't want to go to bed. She found Cressy on the terrace sitting with his tree.
What are you doing, Cress?
Talking with this little fella.
Kid sat next to him and listened.
Doesn't say much, does it?
It's all going on in the roots, he said. Roots tell stuff to other trees.
Like what?
Like where to find water, where to get a good cup of coffee.
Kid tutted.
They warn each other too, said Cress.
About what?
Life, problems, dangers. They're a bit like us, social. They feel neglect and pain.
Do I have roots?
Strong ones. So, you ready for school tomorrow?
What if I don't make friends?
You've got us, said Cress, and Massimo, Asri, and Julia, and Claude. There you go. You've got an orchard.
Cress reached for his beer.
Can I have a sip? She said.
Sure,
he said, because he knew she hated it.
Look out there,
said Cress.
The solar system formed 4.6 billion years ago, and here we are, with a combined age of 77. How young we are. And the Earth spins at 1,000 miles an hour and turns on its axis once every 24. This is what we're governed by, Alice. Space, time, and motion. Hours, days, seasons. Our lives segmented into a series of moments. You see over there? That faint patch of light? That's the Andromeda Nebula. When we look at it, we're looking back 900,000 years into the past.
Big numbers, Cress.
They are big numbers, my love. That's why 10 years of school will go by in no time.
I see what you did there, she said.
I thought you might.
8, said Kid. No more than 8.
All right, said Cress. No more than 8.
And he pretended to spit on his hand, and they shook. Morning came with low clouds and cool air, and Kid wore the dark smock that all the kids wore, with its oversized collar and bow, and she said she looked like a clown. You do, said Ulysses. In the square, she said goodbye to Cress and Julia and climbed onto the crossbar of Ulysses' bike.
There's still time to change your mind, you know, she said.
Yeah, yeah, he said, and pedalled with the traffic heading west to San Frediano. No veering in and out of barrows or motorbikes this time, and he kept a safe distance behind the trams. They passed the tripe cellar and the swallows on washing lines waiting to depart.
Bye, birds. See you next year, shouted the kid.
Up ahead, children gathered at the school gates and Ulysses slowed and the kid jumped off. He wheeled the bike next to her. You be okay, he said, handing her the satchel.
Course, she said.
A teacher came out and rang the bell and children started to head towards the door. I'll see you here later, he said, and bent down to kiss her, but she moved away.
Don't make a scene, she said.
He walked away to a place where she couldn't see him and watched her go in. Stocky little thing with her shoulders back and a fuck-off frown. Other kids were chatting to one another, but not her. She was all peg. He'd kill for her. He'd known that for a while. There he was, skulking in a doorway, no different to Cole. He took the long way back, stopping in art shops and antique shops, hoping to find a globe mould. At home, he made a coffee and opened a pack of biscotti. He pushed back the sofas to the edge of the living room and turned the radio on. Went into his bedroom and brought out the copper plates and laid them next to each other on the floor. There were 6, approximately 16 inches by 55, hundreds of hours of his dad's exacting work. Before he'd left for war, Ulysses had cleaned and polished them, coated them in a light smear of petroleum jelly to protect them. He'd wrapped them in paper and card and had attached to each one a printed sheet that showed the 12 etched gores, the flattened segments of the curved surface of a globe that ran in sequence. Finally, he'd tied old blankets around them because the plates were priceless to him. He knelt down to the nearest one, untied the fabric, and lifted out the print. He moved his finger along the steady presence of the equator line, which cut along the widest point of each gore, dissecting the meridian lines that ran from north to south. The major lines of latitude, the Arctic Circle, the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, and the Antarctic Circle, curved across each segment in a steady sweep. He leant in close. Persia instead of Iran. Constantinople, not Istanbul. Russia still Russia, though. He'd date it somewhere in the late 1920s. His dad, Wilbur, used to trace over a map of the world, and that's how it would start. Names of cities, countries, mountains, rivers, oceans, whatever took his fancy, and always Nora's name somewhere. When he'd finished the trace, Wilbur would flip the paper so the world and its writing would appear in reverse. He would mark a grid system across the paper, and from this template would transfer the information in each square onto a similarly gridded gore, working scrupulously across the 12 sections of the Earth. An instinctive and artistic understanding of the distortion that occurred from flat surface to curve. All the bluster of the racetrack quietened in those moments, the thrill of the wager gone, and the old boy's hand steadied as that reverse image moved from tracing paper to copperplate. Ulysses completed his own trace and etching mere months before his dad died. Countries and lines of latitude and longitude, but no names. He remembered the feeling of achievement as the printed sheet rolled free of the press, the nodding approval of his dad, the cutting out of the gores and marking their sequence, painting the sea and landmass, the smell of glue, positioning the first gore, equator line matching the circumference line he'd drawn around the sphere, the feeling of heartbreak when the paper stretched too much and tore. He sat up and reached for his coffee. It was cold, but he didn't mind. He thought again about the moulds and how to source them. His dad's had been Bakelite, works of art in their own right. He lit a cigarette and sat back. "Oh, Jesus," he said, suddenly registering the time. She was waiting alone by the school gates, and he came to a halt in a screech of brakes.
"What time do you call this?" she said, tapping her wrist.
"Sorry," he said, and bent to kiss her.
"Was it a woman?"
"A copper plate etching."
"Typical."
"How'd it go?" he said.
"I expect I'll get used to it."
"Hungry?"
"What are you thinking?"
They stopped at the tripe cellar and had a sandwich filled with lampredotto. Kid swiped a sip of his wine.
"After the day I've had, who could blame me?" she said.
When they finished eating, he lifted her onto the saddle and pushed the bike along the road.
"You need a haircut," she said,
flicking his ear. "Thanks," he said. School brought structure to the kid's life in a way he hadn't foreseen. She slept when she was supposed to and woke refreshed with the sun. She was held back a year on account of her language, but that would be rectified at the end of the summer term. Her coffee intake was limited to a milky one in the morning whilst reading a book or studying Italian grammar. Being the oldest in her class brought out a care for those less able or those less fortunate, of which there were many. She was ahead in arithmetic and drawing and learning poems, and writing stories wasn't a hardship. She coasted and she knew it, but what did she care? Her dark hair made her invisible in a coterie of other dark hair. She wanted no one to notice her, especially the boys, but sometimes they teased her to get her attention, so she learnt to swear in slang and hit them back. Occasionally she was told off, and occasionally she was praised. "Not so bad," she would have said. Come Friday of that first week, Ulysses, Cress and Massimo met her from school and took her straight to the cinema to watch Fellini's I Vitelloni.
"This'll bring him to the world's attention," she declared during the intermission.
As autumn progressed, Massimo came by with a much-appreciated bottle of new season olive oil. He also informed them that the paperwork was complete and the pensione could now open for business. A week later, he brought a priest round to bless the venture, and Ulysses made sure a good Rosso di Montalcino was ready and waiting. The priest stayed until the bottle was empty and blessed everyone, including Claude, twice. The weather cooled and Cress revisited the long trouser, and Ulysses found a workshop of Via Maggio.
In letters back to England, he described this time as a magic time, a settled time. "I think we've turned a corner," he wrote.
"I'm so sorry to hear Alice's mother is dead," said the teacher.
It was late October. Outside the school gates, incessant rain. The shock on Ulysses' face must have registered as grief, because it brought tears to the teacher's eyes. She expressed great admiration that he was bringing a child up by himself and handed him a chocolate cake she'd made the night before. Flustered, he tried to refuse it, but she'd hear none of it. He staggered over to the kid waiting by the bike, more widower than the robust young singleton he was.
"You look awful," she said,
and she climbed onto the crossbar and proudly took the cake. He cycled back with the kid, oilskins flapping, and went straight to Michaela's for tea. It was warm inside and water pooled beneath the coat rack. Michaela nodded to Ulysses and said something about the weather. Ulysses agreed. His Italian had become conversational. He followed the kid to the back and placed the chocolate death cake on the table between them. Kid ordered a plate of beef ragu with pappardelle, washed down with a chinotto.
"So," she said after a while, "you look like you want to say something, Sunshine."
He wasn't sure how to begin. "Peg's not dead," he said. "Clumsy."
"I know that," said the kid,
and she made a start on her food. "Then why are you telling people she is?" "Alice?" "Look at me," he said. "Why'd you say your mum was dead?" Kid looking defiant now, Peg through and through. "Alice, we can sit here all night if..."
"Because it's better than the truth."
"Which is?"
"That she gave me away."
And the kid's face suddenly flushed, and she was angry, and there was shame, and she began to cry, because she didn't know how to explain any of it. Too young to know the depth of it. All she kept thinking about was the girl in the playground who didn't have any shoes. So Alice told her she didn't have a mother. What's the difference, shoes or a mother? Lack is lack, and it hurts. "Don't, please, don't," said Ulysses, and he tried to hold her, but she ran to Julia. "And that's what I'm not," he thought. "Soft edges and arms that know what to do." He lit a cigarette. How did he not know? How the fuck did he not know what went on in her head? After all this time. He caught Julia's eye, and she smiled that it was okay. Okay was not what it was, he thought. After a while, Kid came back and sat next to him.
"Am I in trouble?" she said.
"Never."
"Can I have some cake then?"
"No. We've been given it under false pretenses, and we'll have to give it back tomorrow."
"That would be embarrassing."
"I'll do it." He did, and it was. Kid asked if she could have some budino instead, and he said, of course. He gave her a coin for the jukebox. She ate the custard pudding whilst listening to Here in My Heart by Al Martino. That night, Ulysses lay next to her until she fell asleep. He looked about at her room. She'd chosen it because of the red and green wallpaper that had images of macaws and trees, a right old jungle. These were the decisions she, as an 8-year-old, made. The way her mind worked, what interested her. Over there, a hook on which hung her swimming costume and diving mask. The side table where she kept her sunglasses and sketchbook. The dried shell of a sea urchin on the dressing table. Her guitar at the foot of her bed. The sign they'd made together to advertise the pensione. These things are the sum of her life now. And she will grow up and leave, he thought. And she will make her way and not cast her thoughts back to him. Life in all its exaltation and complexity will devour her. She will love deeply to the exclusion of all else. And he wants to know everything about her before that happens. But wonders if you can ever know anyone truly. From down the hallway, Ulysses can hear Cressy's heavy breathing and thinks he's sleeping. But really, the old boy is crying. Cress has just finished Forster's novel, and there's a lot to take in. Intellect versus feeling. And Cress is all feeling and love. It's goodbye to the Baedeker, too, since it has become ridiculous through Forster's eyes. The following morning, Cress will abandon it to the living room floor, where it will become a satisfactory doorstop and remain so for years. Cress stands in front of the mirror in his vest and shorts and repeats over and over,
I am vital.
The next day, Cress put down his telescope and wiped his brow.
So, old fella, said the ornamental orange tree, what you gonna do? It's now or never. Is it? Go on. Put a little cologne on those smooth cheeks of yours and show 'em what they've been missing. I'll be rooting for you.
Pause.
That's a joke, by the way.
I know, said Cress.
Cress went to his room and did what the tree said. He positioned his new Panama hat at a jaunty angle and changed his shoes. Unlike Ulysses, he was still a fan of the sock. He walked nervously down the stairwell just as the elderly Contessa was struggling up with a bag of shopping. He tried to help her with it, but she shooed him away with an invective of idiota, a word that even for Cress needed little translation. He said buongiorno to the kids hanging out by the statue, and they said buongiorno back to him with an additional Signor Cress.
Signor Cress, he thought, like a character out of literature.
Ulysses called out to him from Achilles, but Cress was in pure Zen mode. Julia stood by Ulysses' table to watch, and even the priest halted his journey across the square to cross himself. Cress could feel the tension mount in his chest. They approached the stone bench, and the old women looked up and stopped their chat. He touched the rim of his hat and delivered a florid greeting that he'd practiced well and which took them by surprise. He sat on the end of the bench, one buttock dangling precariously off, and from his bag brought out his knitting, a modest four rows of dark brown hem. The old women nudged one another and whispered. Cress raised his needles and said,
Sto lavorando a Maria, Malone senza maniche.
A sentence that plunged him headfirst into the many pitfalls of Italian pronunciation, as instead of informing the women he was knitting a sleeveless sweater, he did in fact tell them it was a sleeveless melon. But it did the trick. A little laughter mingled with something else, and it was the something else that caused Signor Mimi to budge up and give him extra room, the gesture priceless. He spent 2 hours with them that afternoon, simply listening, enjoying their smells and the effervescence of their storytelling. He even told them in faltering Italian that the Mocan Sea tribes didn't have words for I want, take, or mine. This was met with silence, but of the wonder variety. Imagine a world like that, he said. Imagine, they said. And Signora Mimi raised her hand and ordered a tray of vermouth from Michele's. Pensione Bertolini. Beautiful rooms, good price, best location. Ulysses and the kid had been waiting 3 hours in the station concourse and were about to call it a day when the train from Venice pulled in. Out sprang an older couple from Manchester, they would later learn, looking quite at ease in the chaos of Europe. They were Mr. and Mrs. Bambridge, callers Des and Poppy. Des was a businessman and had never walked away from a good price in his life. He stood in front of the sign and said, How good? Whatever you want, said Ulysses. That's no way to run a business, lad.
Never run one before, said the kid.
Come on, Poppy. These two need our help. I'll telephone the Benito and cancel.
You have a view,
said Cress, opening their bedroom door ceremoniously. The bells from Santo Spirito rang out and the divine smell of bistecca wafted up from Michele's, and the evening light was yellow and soft. Des and Poppy were entranced.
Makes the Benito look like a shithouse, said Des.
Look at the Amerini frescoes on the ceiling, Des,
and the quality of the linen. It's stunning.
Cress ran through his speech.
Towels, extra blankets and pillows in there, he said. Bathrooms down the hall, plenty of hot water, etc., etc. Welcome drinks in the living room at your leisure. I'll leave the keys here, he said,
bowing slightly as he departed. Des and Poppy would stay a week, at the end of which the serendipitous element to this encounter became apparent. It was as Ulysses was coming up the stairs after a day in the workshop that Des stuck his head out the front door and said, Fancy a beer, lad.
Ulysses joined him in the living room, where Cress had, only moments before, deposited a few chilled bottles onto the drinks trolley. Des said, "Poppy's in there, sprucing herself up for our last night. We're having wild boar sausages at Michele's. Such a good recommendation. Cheers, lad," he said. "Cheers, Des, and thanks for staying with us." They clinked beer bottles. "The pleasure's all ours." And then Des said, "A young man bringing up a kid by himself. Was it the war?" "Yeah, sort of," said Ulysses. "We do all right, though. I can see that, but I want to help. What I don't know about business you could write on a gnat's arse. A self-made millionaire by the time I was 40. Ulysses whistled his admiration. "Plastics," said Des. "Two words, jelly moulds." Ulysses' ears pricked up. "Can you mould anything, Des?" "Anything. Your head, my shoe." "What about two half spheres that come together to form a perfect whole?" "Consider it done. How many you want? 50? 100? "One. A prototype. Sensible. 36 centimetres in diameter. Inches, if you please, lad. 14.17. Precision. My kind of man." The morning of departure, Des and Poppy handed over an envelope full of cash. Cress looked inside and said, "Jesus Christ, Des." "Worth every penny," said Des, "and I've made a basic business plan for you, a breakdown of what you should charge based on that Bandini place on the corner."
"Des had a snoop around yesterday," said Poppy. "He was pretending to buy it. They've got the added benefit of a dining room, of course. We're not ready for that, Des." "I can see that, lad. So here we have it. Different rates for different rooms. Seasonal adjustments. Get to know your market. Word of mouth's a powerful tool, and I'm going to mouth off at every chance I get. The personal touch is all I've ever known. Change nothing. Get a telephone when you can," and he looked sternly at Ulysses, "and a proper coffee machine. The smell alone is worth a million big ones. And you can offer bed and breakfast. Raises the profile. Me and Poppy love a coffee and a pastry first thing of a morning."
"We do, Des.
Here's my number. I'll let Michele know when the mould's ready and when you can expect it. Now, show us to the visitor's book. We've got an essay to write." After Des and Poppy came the Willoughbys, young newlyweds from Pennsylvania. Cress went overboard with rose petals. The new year brought the two gents, Mr. Rakeshaw and Mr. Crewe. They were fun. Everyone liked them. The Ashleys came next. Then Gwendolyn Fripworth and her niece, who came specifically for the new season asparagus and peas. And that would be the pattern, at least for a year or so, of how the first guests came to stay. A gradual easing into the complex world of hospitality was how Cress described it, till word of mouth spread, and from March to October the rooms were mostly occupied and brought in a modest income that provided all they needed. Every year the priest came by to bless the place, and the length of his stay was measured by the quality of the wine at hand. 4 hours for a particularly good Brunello. Eventually, Ulysses would look forward to November when the majority of visitors left, and the weather became English for 3 months. A lot of rain, a little sleet, and starry nights that brought a mantle of frost. The only guests then were loners or art enthusiasts. Basically, no trouble at all. But we're ahead of ourselves. It's 1953 still, December. The leaves are well and truly off the trees, and an occasional dusting of snow flies in from the Apennines. Florentine women don their furs, and the smell of white truffles mingles with roasting chestnuts. A Principio and Nativity scene arrives outside the church, and the guitar player takes his blues away. After the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, the city shifts its regard, and it's all systems go, go, go. For Christmas. The biggest news at the Pensione Papagallo, as it was now known, was that Des's moulds had arrived. 6 sets, not one, because Des was that kind of man. "Never does anything by halves," said Poppy, showing her 2 engagement rings. And within hours, Ulysses was in his workshop, up to his elbows in plaster of Paris and strips of Hessian. He worked fast, sloshing the liquid up the sides of the mould, adding the Hessian to strengthen, then more layers of plaster. His first attempts were crude, and he used them as practice spheres for the gauze. Which glue held best on which paper stretched too much, which held right, which absorbed watercolour paint and glue the best. The process was slow,
arduous. His aesthetic instinct had grown flabby after a decade of procrastination, and the floor of his workshop became a graveyard for discarded planet Earths. 2 weeks later, however, two hemispheres became a near-perfect one. He took a day to carve off the thick joint seam and to sandpaper the surface smooth. He couldn't stop looking at it. He should have, though. He was late again. "Sorry, Mass, sorry, Cress," Ulysses running across the square. Julia came out of the cafe carrying a tray of coffee. She was wrapped up in a green cardigan, hair piled high and a navy scarf about her neck. She stood in front of Ulysses and placed the coffees on the table. She moved a stray curl of hair away from her forehead. She said, "6 months you've been here, Signor Temper." "Already?" He still found it hard to look at her. "It's true," said Massimo, "almost to the day." "6 months, Cress. What you say? Shall we do 6 months more?"
"I'm not going anywhere, son. Bury me here."
When Julia moved out of earshot, Ulysses leant in and said, "What do you know about angina, Massimo?"
"Not much. My uncle had it."
"He's still alive?"
"No.
A wild boar killed him."
"A wild boar?" said Cress.
"It's more common than you think." "Nothing to do with angina, then?" "It might have made him slower." "You have angina, Ulysses?" "No, no, it's okay. I'm teasing. I know you're talking about Michele."
"How do you know about Michele?" said Ulysses.
"Alice told me." "She told me too."
"No one tells me anything," said Cress.
The postman cycled past and flicked a postcard onto the table, face up, a picture of Big Ben. "London calling," said Massimo. Ulysses turned it over.
"Blimey," he said. "It's Pete. Rosemary Clooney only went and bloody cancelled. He's coming."
A frenzy of activity followed Pete's announcement. Cress went with the kid to buy a tree in the market and brought two on account of the pensione. They found a box of Arturo's decorations in the cellar, and even though the effect was sparse, there was an elegance to the simple strands of silver and gold beading that draped across both floors. Downstairs, the tree had a star on top, and the one upstairs a large blue Amazonian parrot who occasionally came a cropper. Cress and Kid added a touch of the natural, sprays of holly and eucalypts, and the smell was heavenly, said Cress. Heavenly. The word startled Ulysses. He'd never heard Cress use it before, the word having lived solely in the realm of Darnley. Ulysses couldn't shake off memories of the man all afternoon. "You're okay, boy," Cress kept saying. Cress knew he'd gone in on himself, as if he'd taken up residence in the far end of a telescope. "I'm okay," said Ulysses. But the kid said he wouldn't tell us even if he wasn't. When night fell and he was alone, he went out onto the terrace. The pale, unfinished facade of the church glowed like a giant monolith, and he wondered what Darnley would have made of it all.
"Hey, Temps," he could hear him say. "It was never meant to be like this."
"I know." Darnley pulls on his cigarette.
"This square, I mean, not according to Brunelleschi. It should have been built on the other side, where it would have extended down to the river. You'd have arrived at church by boat. How heavenly would that have been? Like Venice."
"Never been, sir."
"Never been? Then we'll go. That'll be a plan."
"Oh, and Temps, you'll call me Alex then." 3 days before Christmas, and still no news from Pete. The weather had turned bitter, and Ulysses was dozing on the sofa after a day freezing in his workshop, with only a couple of small earthenware braziers to keep him warm. Claude was singing to himself on top of the tree, and the medley of Christmas carols and sea shanties wasn't an unpleasant sound. Soon, though, another sound encroached, one that Ulysses thought, indeed hoped, he'd never hear again in his lifetime, or any other come to that.
"What the?"
He jumped up and went to the window, just as the green 1930s English ambulance shuddered into the square, wailing like a slaughterhouse. Claude flew over and landed on his shoulder. He began to molt. "Take it easy, big fella. We don't know it's definitely him yet." But by the time Ulysses had made it down the stairs, Cole's crap wagon had already attracted the attention of his neighbours. The elderly Contessa turned to him and shouted,
"Anything to do with you?"
"Maybe,"
said Ulysses. Typico,
she scoffed and turned away. Pete stumbled out from the passenger side. His face looked paler than usual. He staggered into Ulysses' arms and said, he tied me to a chair, Temps. Wouldn't let me go till I agreed he could come. I spent a week with him in that small space.
Jesus, Pete, that's a bit bubbly.
The sound of Cole shouting and thumping the dash.
Why is he here?
Ginny won't leave Mrs. Core. Peg's off with Ted. He's fallen out with his sister. And I was coming here.
Who's looking after the pub? Hayley Manners, his new woman. She used to run the Victory with an iron fist. Nice coat, by the way.
This old thing, Temps. Had it years.
Suddenly the siren stopped. Cole climbed out from the driver's side and gently closed the door.
What are you doing here, Cole?
Welcome to you too.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
Just wanted to see what it was all about. That a crime?
Of course not.
But knocking that man over in Milan was, said Pete.
You still going on about that? I hardly touched him, said Cole, moving to the rear of the van.
On Cole's back was taped a sign, kick me, in three languages. Ulysses kicked him.
What the fuck do you do that for?
Ulysses pulled off the sign and showed him. Cole turned to Pete.
Don't you close your eyes tonight, he said.
I haven't closed them all week, said Pete.
Got any luggage? Said Ulysses. Pete held up his holdall. A few underpants and socks for me, he said. Cole unlocked the back of the ambulance.
One suitcase, three cardboard boxes.
What's in the boxes, Cole?
Spam, said Pete. He hasn't stopped eating it. It's been like lying next to something dead.
Ulysses stuck Cole downstairs in the pensione, and Pete came to live with them upstairs. It was so he could be near the piano. That was their excuse. But Pete couldn't bear to spend another minute cooped up with the man. And when Pete walked into the living room and saw Claude, he gasped and said,
I never thought I'd see him again. How on earth did...
Nothing to do with me, Pete, said Ulysses. It was all Cress's brilliance.
Got Cress written all over it, Temps.
What's got me written all over it? Said Cress, coming into the room.
Put it here, Cressy,
said Pete, and the two men shook hands.
Pete!
Shouted Kid.
Hello, sweetheart.
Look what I've got, she said, and thrust her guitar his way. I want to play the blues, she said.
And Pete placed her fingers along the fret. Classic territory in the key of E.
That's a good place to start, he said.
Claude took to the air and performed a little aeronautical magic.
Fuck the Palladium,
he chanted on repeat.
Look at that, said Pete.
He's a constant surprise, said Ulysses. You'd think he was too heavy to do something like that, said Cress.
Suddenly, Cole walked in.
Oh, I knew it, he said. That bleeding bird. Who'd want to eat that?
Claude startled and flew straight into the window. He dropped to the floor like a bag of nuts.
Claude, shouted the kid. What should do that for? Said Cress.
Do what? Said Cole.
No one could survive that, said Pete.
But Claude did. And the unfortunate dip in festivities was instantly restored by the suggestion of dinner at Michaela's. Kid led the way.
This is a bit of all right, said Pete, opening the door to the warmth and the smell and the Italian ambiente.
I still don't understand, said Cole,
looking down at the parrot prone in Ulysses' arms.
How'd it get here?
Followed us.
Followed you?
Like a homing pigeon, said Ulysses.
Don't homing mean home?
Not necessarily, said Cress.
Oh, here we go, Dr. Doolittle. Homing also refers to an ability to return to one's territory. Ergo, said Cress. We're his territory.
Julia led them to the table at the back, and Ulysses explained that the bird had just suffered a concussione, he guessed at the word. She gasped and placed a hand to her chest. He wished he'd just told her that he had a concussione. He asked her what the specials were, and she moved close to his ear.
Tortellini in brodo, she purred.
It was as erotic a moment as it had in years. He felt giddy and stumbled against the chair.
Grab the bird, shouted Cress. Grab the bird, Pete.
Pete made a dive for it, caught it inches from disaster.
You're the safest pair of hands I know, said Cress.
Tortellini in brodo,
that first night, was the dish they would talk about for years. Oh, how it nourished them and pleased them, gave them resilience for all the unexpected moments to come.
The salty, porky,
chickeniness of it, said Cole, in a rare moment of Epicurean eloquence. And the floating clusters of field pasta that offer the gentlest of resistance, said Pete.
Al dente, said Chris.
Uzi, said Cole.
To the tooth,
said Chris.
Al dente means firm to the bite. Al dente.
Stop saying bloody al dente, said Cole, wiping a chunk of bread around his bowl. Just when I began to like you again.
Ulysses gave the kid a coin for the jukebox.
This one's for Pete, she said. Ella Fitzgerald, my one and only.
Pete lit a cigarette and made them listen to the piano accompaniment. Hear that, he said. Ellis Larkins, he said. And he played note for note across the make-believe keys. Michele came out from behind the counter.
Signor Tempa, he said quietly. Telefono.
For me, said Ulysses, and he sidled out and followed Michele to the bar. Moments later, he returned.
What's up?
Said Chris. That was Peg.
Peg?
They said in unison. She's coming, said Ulysses.
Coming? Where?
Here.
Here?
Tomorrow. They're in Rome.
They?
Her and Ted.
Ah, not bleeding Ted, said Cole.
On their way to Venice. You're going to have to play it cool, said Pete. Never been good at that, Pete. Me neither, Temps. Don't know why I said it. I'll get the drinks in. And he got up and ordered a round of biciclette. Kid looked worried. She leant over to Ulysses and said,
Why's Peg coming, Uli?
And he said, To see you, of course. And Kid smiled bright.
She's staying with us, Uli.
Nah, kiddo, not this time. He kept it light, but couldn't look her in the eye. You staying with us, Peg?
Nah, Ted wants to stay in the place on the corner.
The Bandini?
That's the one.
A friend of a friend of a friend stayed there. That's some recommendation, Peg, she laughed. Pause. Wish you were staying with us, he added.
Yeah, but you know Ted.
I don't really, said Ulysses. We had room for you, Peg.
I didn't know.
You should have asked. Kid would have loved it.
Will she be pleased to see me?
You don't know how much. The following afternoon, the temperature dropped and the sky tinged yellow and threatened snow. Ulysses blew on his hands and adjusted his scarf, waiting by the fountain in the fading light like a big old Muggins. Cole's words, of course. But he couldn't help himself. He was excited to see Peg, truth be told, and that excitement was the only thing keeping the fug of a hangover at bay. He looked at his watch. Not long now, he was sure. The front door opened and Kid came running out.
Changed my mind, she said.
Frankie Lane's I Believe bled out from Michele's. Kid and Ulysses sang along. A car appeared in the square, the thick chug of its exhaust emphasized by the chill air. Ulysses squeezed the kid's hand, but the car wasn't a taxi and it kept on through into Via Mazzetta.
I thought that was her, she said.
Me too, he said.
Funny we thought the same thing.
Kid began to dance to keep warm.
You should try it, she said.
Okay, I will, he said. Peg and Ted said little in the taxi. How could they go to Rome and Venice and not stop in Florence, Ted's little game? Look at the light, said Peg as they crossed the river. It's just light, said Ted, rereading his three-day-old newspaper. 10 minutes later, the taxi rolled into Santo Spirito and came to a stop outside Palazzo Guadagni. Bare trees and Christmas lights and a glowing church and the perfect symmetry of buildings. And in the middle, a man and a kid dancing by a fountain in the warm pink of dusk. The man and child were laughing, heat from their breath fogging. They looked happy, and that's all Peg needed to see. She could sleep now. Might even be able to forgive herself. She should have left it at that, should have told the taxi driver to keep on going. But all of a sudden, the kid and the man stopped dancing and turned towards her. The man pointed and waved. Ted paid the taxi driver and said, We're not eating with them tonight. Peg opened the car door.
You hear me? Said Ted. Yeah, yeah, she said. The air was sharp on her nostrils, wood smoke and garlic and something grubby. She smoothed her stockings and climbed out, wrapped her fur coat tight around her. She waved and the kid ran towards her, and the kid was all Eddie. Those eyes, that mouth, that hair. Peg knelt down to greet her, but really it was to stop herself from falling. Clack, 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 across the square, Peggy's tune. She was coming towards him, hips swaying, arms swinging, fag in her rouged mouth, other hand clasping the kid, a familiar twinge in Ulysses' guts. Ted left behind on the pavement with the suitcases, pissed off that Peg had moved away without asking his permission. Ulysses went towards her. She threw away her cigarette. The bells from the basilica began to ring. They for me, she said. Who else? He said. Cost me an arm and a leg to set that up. I'm still reeling from the amputation. Peg laughed. They locked eyes, and it was familiar, and there was history. Her breath felt warm on his face, slightly stale but not unattractive. Come here, he said. In one another's arms now. People watching. The elderly Contessa at an upstairs window, Michele and Julia in the doorway of the cafe. You look Italian, she said. That'll be my trousers. Your hair's darker. You reckon? She ran her fingers through the top of it. Suits ya, she said. And you look like you. He held her hands and pulled away to take in the full effect. He whistled.
Hey, interrupted the kid. That's our building there, and that's our cafe, and that's Signor Michele, and Signora Giulia, wave, and that's our fountain.
Peg laughing. Ted was calling out to her. I should go, she began.
And that's our Cressy.
Peg turned, heart sore at the sight of him. The old fella smiled at her. He looked red-eyed and choked.
Call the police, he said. Qualcuno ha rubato tutta la bellezza. Someone's stolen all the beauty.
Words as gold dust, Cress.
What else? He said. Here, have an orange.
He held out a Sicilian tarocco. She took it, pierced the skin with a nail and held it to her nose. Sharp memories.
Come on, said Cress. There's a piano, a glass of fizz and an unconscious parrot waiting for you.
Sounds about right, she said. Ted calling out to her. Peg, exasperated. Go on, said Ulysses. You three go up. I'll help Ted. When they'd gone, Ulysses ran across the stones. All right, Ted. The two men shook hands, both polite. Ulysses said, Kid wanted to show Peg a room. I knew you wouldn't mind. And he picked up one of the cases. Good journey, he said, Ted complaining. Yeah, well, that's this time of year for you. Peggy Temper, walking up the stone staircase as if she was in a film. Find your light, Peg, find your light. The echo of her heels, stair after stair after stair. The bewitching line of her stocking seam, like a musical digit, da-da, da-da, da-da. An old woman on the first floor peeked through the door to watch. Peg smiled that smile, and fuck was it catching. 4 years since that old bat had cracked a grin. The sweet kid up ahead, all chatty this and that with a spray of Italian loquacity. Clever little thing. All Eddie's side, her mum would have said, nothing of you. The atmosphere airless, a bit like a museum. Peg out of her comfort zone, but she didn't know where that ended anymore. What? She said. Cress had stopped and was looking at her.
The truth, he said. Good or bad?
She knew what he meant. So-so, she said, her thighs feeling strong from the climb, her heart thumping wild. I said I'd marry Ted. Cress shook his head and went on up.
Here we are, said Alice. My home.
Two words that shouldn't have affected Peg, but they did.
In here, said the kid.
Peg undid her coat. Heady smells of hot wine and spice and oranges and cloves. Smoke and mirrors in the hallway. Doors leading off to exquisite embroidery and beds. The faint fug of coal from the kitchen. Into the living room she glided, and she shed her fur as if it was spring. Her new brassiere offered up a couple of Heritage Peaks classic Peg. Over to the tree where her perfume mingled with its piney grip. Pete at the piano, lit by candles,
Cole saying something about the idiot in Milan he hit with a car. Nothing changes, and yet... some things do. She stood at the window, the myriad of yellow lights splaying out from shutters, and the bell tower, and the nativity scene, and the dark flit of birds across a navy and magenta marbled sky. Temps and the kid, she'd lost them to this, and in her ears came a roaring sound like waves. Cress handed her a glass of bubbles. She drank it in one, and the sound disappeared. Music and laughter again. Kid handed her the parrot swaddled in a sheet, Pete saying, "It's like looking at the baby Jesus and Mary." "And you're the three wise men, are you?" said Peg. "Dopey, grumpy, sleepy." Claude opened his eyes.
"Peg,"
he said quietly. "What is it, sweetie?" And she leant in close to him. "What is it?" Her ear now at his beak.
"What?" "Don't marry Ted."
"Anyone seen Peg?" said Ulysses. It was Christmas Eve and they were in Michele's having a last-minute cafe corretto before the place shut for 2 days.
"There she is,"
said Cress, pointing out of the window. Ulysses noticed she was wearing sunglasses.
"And now Ted,"
said Cole. "There's Ted," said Ulysses.
"Oh, fuck it,"
said Cole. Kid gave Julia and Michele a present, a signed photograph of Ingrid Bergman. They were delighted.
"I signed it," said the kid.
A walking tour of the city had been planned, but Peg had only brought heels, so Ulysses said he'd drive everyone up to San Miniato al Monte in Betsy. Ted bowed out.
"Oh, that's a shame," said Cole.
Ulysses took them along the Lungarno, heading east. With the river on their left, Kid and Cress pointed to the sights. Uffizi, the National Library, Palazzo Vecchio, Institute of the History of Science.
"The first chronometric devices are in there," said Cress. "The first telescopes, astrolabes, and maritime instruments. The first portable representations of the night sky. And of course,"
Cress, catching his breath,
"Galileo, the father of modern physics."
Peg turned to Ulysses and winked.
"I've missed this," she whispered. Cress said, "Galileo didn't invent the telescope as people think he did, but it was the way he used it. He experimented, he observed, he deduced. His discovery of the satellites of Jupiter proved the Copernican view that the Earth was in fact a satellite of the sun."
"Heliocentrism," said Pete.
"And the great bothering it unleashed," said Cress.
"I wrote a song about it," said Pete. "Not all about you anymore." Pete hummed the chorus as Betsy carved through the undulating Viale Michelangelo into, appropriately enough, the Viale Galileo. From the Church of San Miniato, the group looked out across the city. Peg took off her sunglasses to brush a fleck of mascara out of her eye, and Ulysses was relieved to see the slight red of tears and not a bruise. Cress began to talk about Arnolfo di Cambio.
"Architect, sculptor, designer, city planner," he said.
"But could he make a bacon sandwich?" said Cole.
"Shut up, Cole," said Peg.
Cress ignored him and pressed on. He said,
"It was Arnolfo's vision of 1284 that encapsulated what we see before us. The outline over there of his circuit of walls. Do you see?"
"We see," they said.
"This new city boundary not only highlighted the importance of the river and bridges, but it brought inside the churches of the mendicant orders. Fixed points of the compass, or the cross, let's say. Santissima Annunciata in the north, Santo Spirito in the south, Santa Maria Novella over in the west, and Santa Croce in the east. And there in the centre, in all its majesty, drawing the eye towards it, the cathedral. Il Duomo, representing the glory of the city itself."
Peg found Ulysses in the cemetery. "This him," she said.
"Yeah,
Arturo Bernardini." She sat down next to Ulysses. "You come here often?"
"Not often.
A bit of peace now and then." "It changed my life, Peg."
"You saved his."
"I'm not really sure I did," he said.
"But you were who he remembered." You more than anyone. That's the effect you have on people, Tempy.
Oh, I don't know, he said, and lit a cigarette. Thanks for coming, he added.
I know it cost you.
Peg quiet.
She took the cigarette and said, you know me more than anyone.
How does that feel? Peg didn't answer.
Christmas tomorrow, he said. I hope it snows.
Ted hates snow, she said.
She leant down towards the grave. Make it snow, Arturo. Make it snow for this boy here.
It was Cress who drove Peg and Cole back to the pensione. Pete wanted to walk and Kid wanted to be with Pete, so Ulysses led the way down the steps into San Nicolo. The city was wrapping up. Trams were packed and the last of the shoppers were rushing by with parcels or bags of food. Kid telling Pete about La Befana, the old woman who brings presents to children.
But not on Christmas Day, Pete. On Epiphany, 6th of January. But I'll get mine at Christmas, won't I, Ulysses?
You will.
And if the children are bad, she said, they get a lump of coal.
That's a bit harsh, said Pete. A bit close to the bone, that. They stopped along the embankment and leant over the wall. Ponte Vecchio up ahead, the slow movement of the river below. The hills surrounding the city were dark with a scattering of lights. Somewhere, music. Ulysses lit a couple of cigarettes and handed one to Pete. He liked being with Pete. Pete had quiet junctures. They turned into Via Guicciardini, and Pete said,
mind if I go in there, Temps, and light a few candles? Only time me and the church are at peace.
Of course not, said Ulysses. They veered off towards the open door, past the sentinel Christmas tree, and into the gloom. The church felt warm from bodies, and the strong scent of frankincense lingered. Pete stuck his fingers in the font and dabbed his forehead.
Can't have too many blessings, he said.
I want to do that, said the kid.
And Ulysses lifted her up, and she stuck her hand in the bowl. She flicked water at Ulysses, and he tried to dodge her, and as he did, he caught sight of a painting behind her. And his heart skipped. So there it was. After all these years. Kid slid down and walked off with Pete. Ulysses dug a coin from his pocket, and in no time the gated chapel flared with light and the luminosity of colour. Darnley saying,
Ulysses Temper, Miss Evelyn Skinner, I'd like you to meet Pontormo's deposition from the cross.
Do you think they'd let us take it now, Captain Darnley, and save them the trouble?
Ulysses leant against the bars. Hello again, Evelyn. Remember me? Kid behind him.
I like this painting, she said.
Me too, he smiled. I like the cloud.
Do you want to light a candle? Said the kid. Pete showed me how to do it. You have to think of someone you like. Do you think you could do that?
I think I could. They walked over to an altar.
Pete lit these, said the kid.
There must have been at least 50. Blimey, said Ulysses.
All is women, said the kid. What's an amend?
Making right something that's wrong, said Ulysses. And he picked up a candle and dropped a coin in the box.
Have you thought of someone? Said the kid.
I have.
Is it a woman?
He smiled. Yeah, it is.
Good, she said. Now you light it, that's it. And you think of them really hard. Are you doing that?
I am.
Really hard.
Uh-huh.
Now you can put the candle on the stand. That's mine there. You can put it next to it if you want.
Do you think they know I was thinking of them? Said Ulysses.
Pete says it's like a special telephone call, and they get it even if they're not in.
Is that right?
Who am I to argue?
Night fell early. Kid and Pete went on ahead to the pensione, whilst Ulysses veered right down Via delle Sprone towards his workshop. He walked across Piazza dei Sapiti, and somewhere amidst the spray of Christmas lights, the sound of a violin spoke of loneliness. He put the key in the lock and pushed open the heavy wooden door. He switched on the light, and dust roiled in the flare of the overhead bulb. Three plaster spheres like moons on the upper shelf. The picture was as he'd left it. He'd found a printer in San Frediano after he'd taken the kid to school and had a print made of one of his father's copper plates. 12 gauze, early 1920s. The quality of paper not right for a globe, but perfect for a painting. He'd got it framed locally, nice and simple. He ran a clean rag across the glass, a little bit of wax to lift the frame. He wrapped it in brown paper and tied it with string. "For Massimo," he wrote. He picked up a last-minute bottle of bubbles in Via Maggio before coming into the square. A couple of tourists were looking up at his building. Windows were open, and he caught a glimpse of Cress by the Christmas tree, Pete and Peg giving song to the night. And he thought you'd want to be with them if you were down here looking up. You'd want to be part of them. He ran the stairs two at a time and stopped on the first floor landing. He left the bottle of spumante outside the elderly Contessa's door. He rang her bell but didn't wait. No one heard him come in. He stood in the doorway of the living room and took off his scarf. Peg singing, "That's All." Pete, fag in mouth, down close to the keys, caressing them into another dimension. Cole, next to Cress on the sofa, their movements coordinated, hand to mouth with the cigarette, glass to mouth with the wine. And Kid sitting on the floor, stroking the parrot. Ted standing by the window, being Ted, half in, half out, awkward, stiff and rich. Bloody rum lot they were, but he cared for them. He took Massimo's package into his room and dumped his coat on the bed, Peggy's voice following him across the tiles. In the kitchen, the smell of baked fish and sage. He poured out a glass of wine and came back to his position in the doorway. He couldn't take his eyes off her. He never would. Cress called it a curse and a blessing to love someone so completely, and maybe that was true. Ulysses lifted the glass and drank. He'd long given up trying to fathom what Peg saw in other men. Coming to the end of the song now, she looked at him, smiled just for him. No one had what they had, he thought, not really. He raised his glass to her. The last bars were Pete's, the soft flourish, the gulp of emotion. The midnight bells rang out and echoed against the dark, solemn hills. From the terrace, they watched the congregation file out from the basilica and gather in the square. Cress explaining that the celebrations start after Mass. Then comes the feasting, the opening of presents, the... It's a big deal, Christmas, isn't it? Said Pete. And there's the announcement of the century, said Cole. I meant here, in Italy. Florence, said Ted. And then he paused to drink from his glass. Florence what? Said Cole. Nothing, said Ted. Here we are, in Florence. Cole gripped his stomach and unwrapped his last peppermint. Ulysses came out with a fresh bottle of spumante and segments of panforte. Snack, anyone?
Couldn't eat another thing, said Pete.
How is she? Said Peg. Fast asleep, said Ulysses. You want to see? Ted said,
Of course, Florence isn't Rome.
Isn't it? Said Cole. Even Peg had to smile at that one. She followed Ulysses into the kitchen, placed a couple of coffee pots onto the stove. This way, he said. Through the kitchen and along the hallway, the murmur from the terrace growing faint. They watched the kid sleep, a pillowcase full of presents at the end of her bed. Ulysses pulled her blanket high. Let's go to your room, said Peg. He quietly latched the door behind him. Peg pulled up her skirt. It was a no-knickers kind of night. They fucked against the wall, and it was done and dusted by the time the coffee pot was bubbling. Peg held his face. What? He said.
Coffee!
Shouted Cress. You go in first, he said, breathing hard. But he didn't come out again that night. Left them on the terrace with the bells and booze and the bluster of Col and Ted. He got under the covers and closed his eyes. He heard Peg and Ted leave, that edge to Ted's voice. Peg's silence with men a new thing. When everyone was asleep, he went to the bathroom and washed. He knew he'd have the kid bounding in on him early. Christmas Day found Cress drinking coffee on the terrace.
And here you are, said Massimo, appearing in the doorway.
You escaped your mother, Mass, said Cress. She thinks I'm still in the bathroom.
Buon Natale, my friend.
Happy Christmas, Mass.
Here,
said Massimo, and he handed over a small parcel.
What's this?
Said Cress.
More uncharted territory for a facts man.
Cress unwrapped it.
Well, I never, he said.
Poetry, said Massimo, about a love affair in this city.
Down the spine, Cress read the title, Everything.
Constance Everly, he said.
He flipped through the pages and stopped. He read.
They found a good enough place of solitude, clambered onto the foreshore in the shadow of a bridge. Hands touched cheeks and fingers lips, and there they kissed, because the eyes of the city were not on them. Bells were faint, pronouncing the hour, but what hour? Time had ceased. Somewhere in the air, the quiet cast of a lure whipped the water and sent ripples to their feet.
Pete, soulful and hungover, moved slowly from sofa to piano. He adjusted the stool and took a sip of grappa. He'd woken with the muse and cradled her respectfully. He leant in close to the keys and with his left hand crafted the soft melody, a series of repetitive chords that played themselves after a while, the right hand a gentle improvisation wherever it took him. A song of beauty that uncovered the soul was what Pete offered that day, named it Cress's song after it stopped the old fella in his well-worn tracks. The music led Cress to his mum. Six kids, no money, and only a view from the sink. Christmas just another day. The time he learnt that she too had dreams. Hard to reconcile that pain. Has taken a lifetime, and still not there yet. Peg on the terrace with her kid, drinking in her Eddie looks. 9 years ago, thought Peg, and she's the proof those months were real. Kid looking at Peg. So much to fathom out.
I like it when you sing, she said.
Peg smiled. Kid would always be looking for that smile in women. And Pete played on. Carl at the window, overlooking the square. Ginny would have loved it, but Ginny was with Mrs. Corr and a nephew. Cole knew everything now. His stomach tightened. But if I let her go, then where does that leave me? Massimo unwrapping the world in 12 segments. Ulysses leaning over to show his mum's name hidden in Russia. It's beautiful, Massimo said. He never wanted to lose this friend, and yet there were things still to be said. They could wait another day, another year even. And Pete played on. Ulysses moving through the hallway. He sees Carl in the living room at the window, Cress in the doorway watching Pete, Ted passing him on the way to the bathroom. He opens the fridge and takes out a bottle of spumante. He fills a glass. He goes onto the terrace. Peg and the kid, Claude flying free. He hands Peg a glass, says quietly to her, I'll help you find Eddie. Massimo found me and I'm sure we... It wasn't his name, Temps. Not his real one. I tried, she said. And Pete stopped playing. Dusk dimmed the room, and the constellations on the ceiling, all but invisible in daylight hours, were brought to life by the fading light. Pete got up and switched on the lamps.
Hey, it's snowing, he said.
They gathered at the window.
Well, I'll be, said Ulysses.
I hate snow, said Ted. It doesn't much like you, said Cole.
Peg smiled. Down below in the square, Signora Mimi was waiting.
It's Signora Mimi, said Cress. I wonder who she's waiting for.
You, they said.
But I don't have anything for her, he said.
You, they said. He grabbed the nearest coat, which happened to be Peg's fur, and was about to run out when...
Where's my poetry book? He said.
From the upstairs window, Ulysses and Peg, side by side, watched Cress enter the empty square. He and Signora Mimi held hands and moved towards a bench. Cress brushed it free of snow, and they sat down facing one another. Cress opened his poetry book, and his words became mist. Christmas 1953 was one for the visitor's book. They all wrote a version of, We'll be back, but they wouldn't, not like that. They left the next day, Peg and Ted as early as decency would allow, and the margins on that were close. Peg hugged the kid awkwardly, and Ulysses had to look away. Ted went off and loaded the taxi.
Remember what I said,
Claude. and Peg would remember, but she wouldn't adhere to it. Ted and Peg would be married in June and would become Mr. and Mrs. Holloway. They'd honeymoon in Paris. Nowhere like it, Ted would say. Cole was next to leave. You don't have to go, said Ulysses. Yeah, I do, said Cole. He missed Jenny, truth be told, and England.
I don't make sense anywhere other than that small corner of London, said Cole. I'm one of them blokes who needs to know what's what. Spam on Tuesday, fish on Friday.
We do that here, said Ulysses. We're not that different. Cole offered his hand.
Bye, Temps. Don't be a stranger.
See you, Cole.
Cress, old fella. Thanks for coming.
Sure I can't change your mind?
Said Cole, turning to Pete.
No thanks, Cole. I'll need to go it alone on this one.
Cole climbed into the driver's seat. As soon as the key engaged, the scream of the ambulance filled the square. Cole leant out of the window.
Spam's in the cellar, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. And then he was gone.
How are you getting home, Pete? Said Ulysses. I'll hitch, Temps. I need time to think. Freedom of the open road and all that. I'll get a song out of it, if nothing else.
Freedom of the Open Road became a hit around the clubs a year later.
You always have a home here, Pete. We need you.
Pete collapsed in Ulysses' arms. He said,
One day, Temps, you're like the brother I never had. I did have one, but we never really...
I know what you mean, Pete. Pete lifted his holdall onto his shoulder and stuck out his thumb. A minute later, he got a lift with a wine merchant heading to Bologna. And then they were alone. Two men, a kid, and a parrot.
Listen,
said Cress. They listened.
Peace,
said Cress.
Nice, isn't it?
Said Cress. We do all right, don't we? Said Ulysses. Just us. They moved across to the lights of Michaelis, which had just come on.
And so another year approaches,
said Cress.
I wonder what it will bring, said Ulysses.
More of the same, said the kid. Who's buying?
So, 1954? More of the same? No, not really. Cress became the owner of a red Moto Guzzi Falcone, complete with sidecar. His confidence with Betsy had waned. He needed something practical in which he could transport the heavier laundry to Manfredi, but also something nippy and eye-catching. He bought it with some of Fanny's winnings, of a man who'd recently lost an arm. He got a good price. A small crowd formed in the square the afternoon Cressy pulled up on his machine. Cressy's smile shone out from under his helmet as people stopped to chat with him. He rarely had a clue what people were on about, but by the luck of the gods, he understood most of it. Bit of an oracle was Cressy. The kid? She grew strong roots and a fury you could light a fire with. She practiced guitar, and she began to sing, and the voice that came out was Peg's. She made friends at school, but kept to herself outside those gates. She wrote to Peg once a month, but sometimes she drew a picture instead. Peg sent over a photo of Eddie. It was her only one, and Peg told her to keep it safe. Kid kept it hidden from Ulysses, because she didn't want to hurt him. And Ulysses acquired many more Italian words, and still spoke with an East London lilt. He couldn't roll his R's and would never be able to do so. To some, he was still known as Soldato, something he'd have preferred not to have been called, but he stayed magnanimous. In March, two noticeable things. He glued the last gore to a sphere and created a globe. He began to source carpenters who could make the stands. He also had sex with an American tourist in a hotel over by Piazza dei Ciompi. The experience was wonderful and long overdue. He said goodbye to her in the early hours and wandered back through an empty city. Somewhere a flower seller was setting up a stall. Twilight filled with scent, hard to beat. And standing in the wide expanse of Piazza Santa Croce, the first lights came on in a cafe, the first sound of donkey and carts rolling up through the streets with the new day's produce. Sunrise breaking somewhere behind the Casentino. And the moon, the beautiful satellite, shone white and full and entranced. And he became aware of the universe, that endless canopy of chance and wonder. He leant against the statue of Dante Alighieri and lit a cigarette.
he said. I was supposed to come and give you someone's best a long time ago, so I'm doing it now. Evelyn is her name. Evelyn Skinner.